Welcome to Scope It Out. In this edition, Dr. Smith will be speaking with Professor P.J. Wormald about his article, Stress Response and Communication in Surgeons Undergoing Endoscopic Management of Major Vessel Hemorrhage, a Mixed Method Study. This edition of Scope It Out is sponsored by Medical Center Pharmacy, leaders in topical sinus therapy for chronic sinusitis and polyp patients. Founded in 1990, MCP provides innovative formulations that combine steroid, antibiotic, and antifungal treatments. These medications are instilled directly into the sinuses using various devices. Successful insurance billing, thorough patient education, and prompt delivery are why physicians and patients trust MCP as their premier pharmacy. Please visit www.mcpnc.com or call 1-800-930-8785 for more information.
Hello and welcome to Scope It Out, the podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm your host, Dr. Tim Smith, and today I'm very happy to be joined by Professor P.J. Wormald from Adelaide, Australia. We'll be discussing his article, which is currently available in Early View online, entitled Stress Response and Communication in Surgeons Undergoing Training in Endoscopic Management of Major Vessel Hemorrhage, a Mixed Method Study. P.J., welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Tim.
I was really interested in having you on the podcast to discuss this article because I think even though your methods examine the response of the surgeon to a major vessel hemorrhage like an internal carotid artery injury, which is indeed a potentially catastrophic event, I think the results are even more generalizable to any surgeon who really has ever experienced a major complication in surgery. And in fact, I think we all, by virtue of our training and our experiences, have been involved in situations where major complications have occurred, and we're all acutely aware of the physiological changes that seem to accompany these types of events. And it's really not something we've actively talked about or studied much. And you bring up the point in your manuscript that the aviation industry, on the other hand, with flight simulation, they practice these things all the time. How do you communicate effectively with the team during these moments of very high stress? And how do you continue to function at the highest level even when you're under great duress? So I guess, first of all, PJ, I'm interested in how you became interested in this topic and studying this topic.
It was quite interesting. We were quite surprised at the responses of the surgeons to their realism of the model. And we had some surgeons who were, we thought, were very experienced. In fact, some leaders in our specialty in the world who'd come to the course to do the course. And what we found was that one of the surgeons had such an acute stress response during the arterial model when he actually had a complication in the model itself, where he actually nipped the side of the vessel before he had properly exposed it, so we couldn't even go through the steps of teaching him how to manage it, that he had such an acute stress response that we actually had to take him away from the model, lie him down, and look at him. In fact, we were worried that he might be developing some cardiac event. And we thought, having talked to other people who had been on the course, that they felt that it was so realistic that their stress response was so significant that we thought we should try and document or research this in some way to see what and how the stress response occurred and what we could learn from it in terms of how the outcomes would be managed depending on how you manage your stress response. Mm-hmm. So that was the sort of motivation behind putting the study together and trying to put some science behind what we were sort of observing on the courses that we've run.
I'm familiar with your model, but many of our listeners may not be. And I know you're very fond of sheep in that part of the world, right, PJ?
So we are. But the sheep don't get that fond of us. But anyway.
Yes. Well, tell us. Yeah, tell us about the model. Like, what does it look like?
So the model is a low venous pressure model and a very high pressure arterial model. So what happens is we dissect out the jugular vein and we dissect out the carotid artery. And what we want to do is we want to teach the surgeons the steps in the low pressure situation, which the bleeding is not catastrophic and doesn't threaten your view with your endoscope as much as a high pressure arterial model does. So we want to give the surgeons the confidence or the skills to manage the bleeding in a low pressure model. And once they have managed to learn those steps, then we move them onto the high pressure model, which is almost exactly the same as it would be if you hit a carotid artery during surgery. The sheep's blood pressure is the similar mean arterial pressure as what we have in humans. Their blood volume is similar. It's about 4.5 liters in a sheep. We also have the sheep on significant resuscitation. So we have signed a registrar to monitor the arterial pressure. All of the sheep have arterial pressure monitors in place, and resuscitation is active and significant. And we would have in one of our models up to 12 liters of resuscitation that go through by the time the course is completed.
Wow. Wow. So you and I have seen in an internal carotid artery bleed in the operating room before, and I'm curious, is the model truly representative of what you've seen intraoperatively?
It's almost exactly the same in terms of what you manage and how you see it intraoperatively. The major motivation behind us developing the model was a intraoperative injury that occurred to me earlier on, you know, I think it was 15 years ago, and we were doing a skull base case, and we had a major bleed, and the responses that we had from the team as complication were such that I felt we could do better. We could change the outcomes for these patients if we could do better. And I, having had that experience, which that's what motivated me to try and develop a model which we could train surgeons on. And you might be aware or might not be aware of the paper that we published in IFAR 3 or 4 years ago, in which we surveyed 140 surgeons who had been through the training on the model previously. And we know in the literature that about a third of the patients who undergo such a major vessel injury will have a morbidity, and it's normally some sort of stroke or some significant morbidity associated with it. About a quarter of the patients will die as a consequence of the injury, and the rest will come out unscathed. And when we surveyed the surgeons who've been through this training model, we found that none of the patients died. We had no morbidity. In other words, we had no patients who had any stroke or any significant central nervous system poor outcome, and all of our patients survived. And so we think that being able to simulate this high-stress environment is something which really gives the tools to the surgeons to be able to deal with these sort of complications in a way that they didn't have the tools to do so before. And I think if you look at the aviation model, that's what they're doing in the aviation models, is they're putting these scenarios together in a very realistic format and creating those stress environments, which then teach the pilots the tools to be able to deal with these high stress environments and to potentially improve the outcomes of something which has gone bad.
Right, right. And you and I would agree that we recognize that the sacrifice of the animal in these cases, I mean, we take that kind of thing very seriously in medical research in this day and age, right? But in this case, you're talking about sacrificing an animal to improve the outcome of a major complication in humans, which is faced not infrequently, well, hopefully infrequently, but you know what I mean. It's not a rare event to have an injury like this and to have morbidity from things like this in skull-based surgery in particular.
Yeah, I think skull-based surgery is certainly the subspecialty of ours, which would be faced with this on a more common basis. You find that sinus surgery, it is a rare event.
Right.
But skull-based surgery, it's not. And, you know, a lot of our tumors these days that we deal with are vascular encasement. In other words, they encase major vessels. And the nature of the beast is that if you're going to remove the tumor from around these vessels, it is just a matter of time before you are going to have to deal with some major vascular injury. You know, I think that we were very cognizant of the fact that, you know, we are using a large animal model as part of our training purposes. But, you know, every day, hundreds of thousands of sheep are humanely put to death to feed the population of the world. Utilization of these animals is under the control of the Animal Ethics Department, and they you know, these animals are very humanely managed prior to us doing our dissections on them and euthanized at the end of the surgery. So there's not a lot of difference between provision of food on a large scale basis and the utilization of those animals or using those animals for a different purpose, which is to train surgeons to be able to respond to something which is potentially life-threatening for our patients. One point I'd like to pick up, though, I think that your opening introduction, you stated the fact that complications provide stress response and not necessarily a major vascular complication. And I couldn't agree with you more on this point. I think that any of us who've had complications, you know, whether it be a CSF leak, whether it be an orbital fat exposure, whatever it might be in sinus surgery, will know that sinking feeling, that flush that you have of a major sympathetic response where your everything dilates, your heart drops, that whole feeling. And being able to manage that situation, to be able to effectively communicate, to be able to effectively generate the team to respond appropriately, and to not let that affect what you know are the next steps to managing the complication and getting a good outcome for the patient, I think is vital training, which we sort of overlook. There's no scenario which we can really put that together as part of our training of our residents before they actually become consultants and go out into the big world.
Right, right. And I feel like, gosh, I would wager that there's not a single surgeon listening to this who has not felt that physiologic response before at some point during their career. And they've probably felt it multiple times here and there over the years of their career. But you're right, we've never really trained it. We've never really exploited our understanding of the physiology and the psychology and how to put that together to make it better. Whereas, as you've said, in the airline industry, they've been doing this for years.
Yeah, they have. You know, I think for them, having these aircraft simulators, it really provides them that opportunity. Unfortunately, the simulation in sinus surgery that we've had to date is not realistic, and it doesn't produce the stress response, and it's not something which, you know, you get that massive release of sympathetic hormones in your body, and it gives you that sinking feeling, that flush, that feeling that you actually, if you're standing, you have to sit down, you know, that feeling that we have. And so this model does provide that. So whether we can have other models which we can simulate, or other ways we can simulate this, I don't know, and I think that's something for the future researchers to try and explore. I think that the surgeons that we've had come through this course have almost uniformly said that, you know, this is one of the best training experiences that they've had in their lives as surgeons, just being in the situation where it is so realistic and where they can look at their responses objectively and where they can try and analyze what they're doing, how they're communicating with the team. We set it up very realistically. Every station has a scrub nurse, fully trained scrub nurse. We have instruments.
This would be a circulating nurse in the U.S.
Yeah, I suppose you would. Yeah, so we would. Yeah, so we, you know, so we get from our operating theaters because we feel the nurses are such an important part of the team, and that the nurse needs to know what to do as well. It's not just the surgeons, and it's not just the surgeons and the nurses, the anesthetists as well. So the team really needs to respond as a whole to this situation.
As you measured this physiological response, and it had a lot of face validity to me because the heart rate and the mean arterial pressure, they both went higher in the arterial bleed model than they did in the venous bleed model.
Yeah, it was quite significant. You know, the differences between the arterial and the venous models. That does give us, we were quite surprised the salivary amylase didn't rise.
Yes.
But, you know, what is an objective measure of a sympathetic response? And this was the only one we could find in the literature. And we thought that the anticipation of going through the training of the course might have activated the sympathetic system, and that's one of the reasons, possible reasons, why we didn't see such a big difference, because we swabbed them as they took the endoscope and everything into their hands before they put the endoscope into the model for the first time.
Right.
That is the time point which we swabbed them. We didn't swab them when they arrived.
They're probably
in 4 days.
Yeah, they're probably already forecasting in their mind that they're getting ready to have a great stress response. They're imagining what's happening, so their sympathetic nervous system probably already firing at that stage.
at that point in time, we've already been through all the surgical steps with them as part of a lecture series that we do to prepare them, to teach them the steps and what to do and how to manage it. So they've already had a sort of hour and a half exposure to all the videos and talk about it. So, you know, you wonder whether there was some salivary amylase or sympathetic activation which occurred during the lectures, and that maybe, I'm speculating obviously, but might be the reason we didn't see a difference in the salivary amylase levels.
Right, and you did see a difference in the confidence level in terms of being able to control a major vascular bleed pre-event and then post-event. They really rated their confidence in managing something like this much higher.
Yes, they did, and I think that I've had a couple of surgeons in my own department who had subsequently been through the course have had a major vessel injury, and the one surgeon came to me and said, I don't think this patient would have survived if I hadn't been on the course.
Right.
So they had a major carotid blowout there. They had a pituitary tumor which had encased the carotid and pushed the carotid right forward onto the anterior face of the sphenoid. And the carotid was injured with the kerosene taking down the face of the sphenoid, even before they even got into the actual sphenoid itself.
Right.
So, you know, so this
that's
was
not fair.
You know, these things. There, I was right. So these things happen, and he said, you know, without having had this training, he didn't believe the patient would have survived.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that having these training, having this confidence, because you know what to do, you know what the steps are, you know how to keep the scope clear. You know that if you don't keep the scope clear, you're not going to be able to deal with the bleed because you can't see to be able to put anything on the vessel to be able to control that hemorrhage. So the skills that you develop as a consequence of going through that process, I think, are quite unique.
How about the finding that you suggested that surgeons with greater experience, meaning not greater experience necessarily with major catastrophic vessel injury, but more experience with endoscopic surgery, endoscopic sinus, and skull-based surgery, they had a higher heart rate during the arterial injury training than those with less experience?
It's probably more realistic for those surgeons who've had more experience. And the surgeons who've had more experience might be considering the likelihood of them being having to deal with something like that is something which is of a much higher likelihood than surgeons who hadn't had that experience or that exposure before. I can't think of any other reason for it.
Yeah.
Jim, but, you know, that would be my sort of take on that.
I guess the other thing I was thinking is that the less experienced surgeon just stepping up to the model might already be at a certain elevation of their heart rate, more elevated than the experienced person who steps up to the model. They've stepped up many, many times to a situation like this, so their heart rate starts a little lower, and the difference goes maybe.
I think that's probably a better explanation than mine, I think that's probably more correct, because I think the more experienced surgeon is not going to have a high heart rate when he picks it up just to expose the vessel.
Right, right.
You know, that's something he's done before.
He's used to doing.
It's not something which stresses him out, yes.
So what do you think the future of simulation looks like, both with your model and just in general? Are you interested in continuing to explore this area and advance this frontier? Obviously, this is a huge frontier you have breached just by introducing this model, but are you still moving forward on this?
Yes, we continue to. So what we're doing now, because large vessel injury is uncommon, it really is in skull-based surgery, but small vessel injury is not.
Right.
So, you know, almost every case we do has a small vessel injury as part of the tumor removal. So what we've done now is we've taken the model and we've opened up the frontal sinus of the sheep, and we're putting the model onto that open frontal sinus. We then, as part of our development of our course, we're now doing a craniotomy through that posterior wall of that frontal sinus. We then go into the middle cerebral artery and the small branches of that, and we're creating a model of small vessel injury. So the same animal will be utilized in the first instance for management of small vessel injury, which is a common occurrence and something which every surgeon will deal with in almost every case, and giving the surgeons the tools to manage small vessel injury and then to close the skull base is one of those steps that we will teach, and then go to the large vessels and then go through the life vessel injury. So we want to keep moving this forward. We want to keep exploring these frontiers because we think that the skill set that we are giving our surgeons coming through these courses is something which is invaluable and something which they won't be able to easily acquire in a non-model situation.
I think that's just such a great idea because it just shouldn't be that you have to be out of your training for 10 years to gain these experiences. We should be teaching this to our registrars and our residents. We should be training them on how to manage these things and giving them these experiences during their training.
I think it's invaluable. And, you know, I think that we wanted to try and sort of explore that. And that's one of the reasons why we did the survey of all the surgeons that had gone through the course prior to see what the outcomes were if they had an injury subsequent to being trained on the course. And we thought that the outcomes that we showed in that study really did show the difference between surgeons who hadn't been at this training or exposure, if you look at the outcomes in the literature versus the surgeon
right.
who had. And, you know, I think that it's sort of pretty obvious that, you know, we should be encouraging our surgeons,
yeah.
especially those starting out who don't have experience to go through this sort of training, to be able to have the skill set that will improve the outcomes of the patients. Because everybody has complications. You know, I always tell my residents and registrars, the only surgeon that doesn't have complications to deal with during surgery is the surgeon that doesn't operate.
It's absolutely true. This article that we're referring to, this second article that we've been referring to, is also in the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I feel like, PJ, that was 2 or 3 years ago. And
that's
I forget correct. What proportion of the folks who'd been through the course actually went on to experience a major vessel hemorrhage, but
so
it was substantial.
Yeah, 140 surgeons who went through the training, and it was about a 5-year period, which we surveyed them on. There were 12 injuries that have occurred from those 140 surgeons.
Yeah,
that's a fairly significant number, the 12
right.
injuries that we
right.
that we had outcomes to.
And there were no major, you know, catastrophic morbidities or mortalities from those injuries, as I recall from that article.
There was not a single patient that died, so we had no mortality. We had no morbidity either. We did
yeah.
have a much lesser incidence of pseudoaneurysm formation, and we had 3 patients that needed to be stented that weren't managed by, you know, just the standard treatment muscle patch graft. And, you know, we had a variety of vessels that were injured, you know, vertebral arteries, basal arteries, carotid arteries. In the past, a basal artery injury during surgery was considered fatal.
Right.
If you look 10 years ago, there wasn't much that you could do if you injured the basal artery, and most neurosurgeons would say, well, that would be a fatal outcome for the patient.
Right. Well, it's fascinating. Have we hit on all the high points? Any other points to bring up about this topic?
I think that we've covered most things, but Tim, I really do think that your point that this is applicable not just to a major vessel injury, but to management
yeah.
of all complications, I think is a very valid one, and one that we should think about more, whether there is simulation which we can get to simulate the more common things that we see in sinus surgery, such as CSF leak and orbital injury, that would be something which, you know, we really need to try and look at developing in the future.
Well, thank you again, PJ. Your work is really, it's truly fascinating. I saw your article and I knew I wanted to talk with you about it, and I really did feel like it applies to all of us in some way, shape, or form. So thanks so much for joining me on the podcast, and we certainly look forward to reading your future work as well.
Be my pleasure, Tim.
Thank you, PJ. I'll see you somewhere soon.
Thank you for listening. Scope It Out is a co-production of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology and Wiley. All opinions in this podcast are those of Dr. Smith and his guests and do not necessarily reflect those of Wiley or of the sponsors.